Everybody who thinks the NAFTA renegotiation is a done deal, take two steps forward. Hey, you there. Not so fast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In St. Paul today, the studios of Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 28th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. At the risk of muddying the international trade waters more than they have already been muddied, we begin today with an update to developments in the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. While noting that the Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland was back in Washington today trying to get Canada back in that three-party deal after yesterday's news that Mexico and the United States have come to terms, the update for the White House goes a little bit like this. Hold your horses. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson introduces us to something called Trade Promotion Authority.
Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, sets up this quid pro quo between Congress and the president. Congress gives the president the authority to go out and negotiate trade deals.
That's the quid.
Bill Reinsch with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Congress sends the president off with goals for those deals and lots of rules and timetables for telling them what he's up to.
The quo from Congress is that if the president does all the things that TPA tells him to do, then Congress agrees to consider the agreement that he brings back in a timely fashion without any amendments.
A simple majority vote. And Congress can't change the carefully negotiated terms of the deal. Here's the thing. Last May, the president notified Congress, like he's supposed to, that he wanted to revise NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. So what happens if he comes to Congress for a vote on a deal without Canada? White House officials say it'd still qualify for these so-called fast-track provisions. But Jennifer Hillman, a professor at Georgetown Law, doesn't see it that way.
In my view, coming back with an agreement that's only between the United States and Mexico is not consistent with that law.
Ultimately, Congress will decide that question. Already, senators from Pennsylvania and Texas have expressed doubts that a U.S.-Mexico deal would qualify for that simple majority, no amendment vote. Without fast-track provisions, Hillman says it'd be a much tougher slog, though not impossible, to get the deal through Congress.
Any one amendment that passes has the potential to take down the agreement unless you go back to the Mexicans and get them to agree to that provision, and then you've got to bring that revised bill back again.
And now you see why Fast Track exists in the first place. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We were doing a whole lot of stories a year or so ago about what looked at the time like a retail apocalypse. Department stores, malls, anything built out of bricks and mortar, all pretty much crumbling in the face of online retail. As we sit here in mid-2018, though, things could not be more different. We've seen strong quarterly results the past couple of weeks from everybody from Target to Tiffany's, Best Buy just this morning. So Marketplace's Justin Ho has the retail update.
Today is one of the hottest days of the year in New York City, but that hasn't stopped shoppers from pouring into the flagship Macy's in New York's Herald Square, and they all have their reasons.
So I always go to stores, and yeah, my experience today was like really good.
It's all about the fit, right? So if it doesn't fit well, then there's no point buying it online.
I make more money now, so I'm more comfortable shopping because I can pick up whatever I want.
That's Michael Toom, Richard Oy, and Shrenette Chambers. This month, Macy's said improved consumer confidence is driving stronger sales. Target reported that foot traffic in its stores is up more than it's been in over a decade. Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail.
The store, the physical store, and the need for it on the part of shoppers has not gone away.
She says online sales are strong too, and that's not just Amazon. Nordstrom, Best Buy, and Walmart are all finding their way online.
The ones who aren't good are gone, and the ones who are smarter and investing are doing much better.
Over the last year, the retail job market has grown only about a third as fast as the private sector as a whole. Heidi Shierholz is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She says the real job growth in the sector is in warehouse fulfillment centers, and wages there aren't great. So
it's just not having a big, meaningful impact on the overall quality of jobs.
But pressure is mounting on retailers to improve wages. And this morning, Best Buy said that paying more to employees will eat into its profits. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you're in the market to buy a house, this next story might be somewhat reassuring. Somewhat because, according to the closely watched S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index, those home prices are still going up, just not as fast as they had been. June was the third straight month of slowing increases, if that makes sense. Now, Does that mean the housing market is turning, or is it just moving around like markets do? That's the assignment Marketplace's Amy Scott got.
Remember, all real estate is local, right? Well, in Las Vegas, prices were up about 13% in June. In San Francisco, almost 11%. But only about 4% in New York and 3% in D.C. In Tony Montclair, New Jersey, agent Diane Russell says she's noticed a change.
Last year, for a house that was, you know, low 600s, you might have 12 offers.
This year, she's seeing maybe 4 or 5.
Now, they're still really good offers, well over ask, but it's not the craziness that what we were seeing last year.
Less crazy is far from a downturn. Craig Lazera with S&P Dow Jones Indices says rising interest rates may be taking some of the air out of the market.
As rates go up, obviously housing becomes less affordable, and that will cause demand to increase at a less robust rate, let's say.
And some sellers are getting the message. Zillow says more owners lowered their asking prices in June. Sam Cater, chief economist at Freddie Mac, says the market is due for a reality check.
The acceleration in home prices were outpacing incomes. So I think the slowdown is a good thing for home buyers.
But Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics cautions a few months of data do not a trend make.
Realistically, inventories are still very, very tight. And that again suggests that what we're seeing, these kind of wiggles in the market, are nothing more than that. They're just wiggles in the market.
But to a first-time buyer looking to get into the market, even a wiggle may feel like progress. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One more indicator today, just because consumers in this economy are feeling better than they have in 18 years. Consumer confidence is the official term. On Wall Street today, they were not terribly confident, I would say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This might seem like just another sleepy week in late August to a lot of you, but for students of economic history, 10 years ago, just about now, we were getting ready for the fall. The fall of Lehman Brothers and AIG, bank failure after bank failure. I don't think I need to go on. We've been marking the 10th anniversary of the crisis by talking to some of the people whose job it was back then to fix things. Ben Bernanke at the Fed, Hank Paulson, and Tim Geithner at Treasury. Also yesterday, and the reason actually that I'm in St. Paul, Neil Kashkari. Today, he's the president of the Minneapolis Fed. 10 years ago, he was an assistant treasury secretary under Paulson, running the Troubled Asset Relief Program, better known as TARP, the $700 billion bank bailout that originally the House voted down. Here is just a part of that interview I just did with him.
Is it true that that $700 billion number, basically you guys pulled out of thin air? Trillion would have been too much, 500 probably not enough?
Yes, we wanted as much authority as we could get because the one mistake we kept making throughout the crisis was we kept underestimating how severe it was. So we said, we're going to get one shot to go to Congress. We need as much authority as we can get. And ultimately, it was his political judgment on how much he thought we could convince Congress to give us.
Let me fast forward a little bit. As you sit here now as a Fed president, as a banking regulator, and as a guy who's been through the crucible, as it were, why didn't we know how bad it was going to get?
We never know when these crises happen, how bad they're going to get or that they're going to happen. And that's the nature. It's, you know, there's a human societies are prone to what I call these mass delusion events repeatedly, whether it's the tulip bubble way back when or the stock market before the Great Depression, the tech bubble, or now the housing bubble that we had in 2006, 2007. It's a mass delusion event where everybody believes something positive is happening when in fact it's the opposite. And so, you know, I bought a house in California in 2005. I sure didn't see it coming. I was part of the mass delusion. So I don't know. But I know it's going to happen again. So the question now is what can we do now from a regulation perspective to put in some guardrails so that when it happens again, it doesn't bring down the whole economy.
All right. So we'll get there in a minute, but I want to go back to the day the House failed to pass TARP, right? Where were you? What were you doing? What was your reaction?
I was sitting in the gallery over the House floor.
Oh, were you really?
I was watching the vote. And we left there dejected. The only thing we could comfort ourselves with was saying, history will show that we asked. Paul Sam Bernanke went to Congress. I was there when they met in then Speaker Pelosi's conference room, House and Senate leadership, bicameral, bipartisan. And they said, basically, the U.S. economy is on the verge of collapse. We don't have the tools to deal with it. We need Congress's help. History will show that we're asking you for help. And so that was the only minor comfort that we had, is that history would show that, yes, we did in fact warn them. We did in fact ask for help. And they said no,
ouch,
which was not very comforting.
Wow, right? That's not what you want to hear.
Yeah.
So then what happened? You leave the gallery and does Hank get on the phone with Pelosi, or what happens?
We went back to Treasury, and Hank started working the phones again, and the White House started working the phones again. And thankfully, I mean, to be honest with you, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 777 points that afternoon. And members of Congress had been telling us, our phones are ringing off the hook 99-1, saying, don't you dare vote for this. There's no crisis, because Main Street hadn't felt it yet. Then when the Dow dropped 777 points, their phones started ringing, not 99-1 the other way, but more 50-50, saying, oh my gosh, what did you just do? You better do something, Mr. Member of Congress.
That was Neel Kashkari, now the president of the Minneapolis Fed, then the guy running TARP. Lots more in our talk about Too Big to Fail, the Fed and interest rates today, and the crisis next time when that whole interview airs. That's going to be Tuesday, the 4th of September, right after Labor Day. Our project marking the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis is called Divided Decade: How the Great Recession and the 10 years since have changed this economy and the people in it. And we've been asking you to share your stories of that change. Today, 34-year-old Chad Loy, he's from Muskegon, Michigan.
I graduated in 2003 from high school and kind of aimlessly wandered around the college halls for a couple of years, kind of just thinking, what do I want to do with my life, I guess? And my girlfriend at the time, I think she was kind of going through the same thing, and we decided to just, you know, say screw it and bought a boat and sailed away. It was this kind of old, leaky 26-foot sailboat, you know, with wooden decks and everything. And we moved it from our parents' houses onto the boat together. And that was how we moved in together. We left in September 2007. We sailed out of the Great Lakes where we're from, through the Erie Canal to the Hudson River and out to the Atlantic Ocean. And then we just kind of sailed around. We arrived in the Bahamas in 2009, and when we were there, we got married. We were in the Exumas, which is this really remote part of the Bahamas. Not a lot of internet connection, no cell phones. And then we had this great idea that, you know, hey, you know, sailing's been fun, but we have this, you know, leaky boat and we don't have any savings. Maybe we should go back home. Our bright idea was to take over my parents' painting company in the commercial construction industry. And that turned out, obviously, to be a really bad idea. Michigan had been hit pretty hard by the recession. We really just had no idea how bad things really were. The future was very cloudy. So in 2010, I started working as a virtual assistant out of my living room. I had these business owners from around the country who were super appreciative of the things that I could do for them on a computer. And as I was getting the projects, I just started calling my unemployed friends to come over and work with me in my living room. You know, I kind of just wasn't really thinking about starting a company, but we had grown to 23 employees by 2014. So in 4 short years, the company had really exploded. Had the recession not happened and had it not clouded the future of the construction industry in Michigan, I don't think I would be where I am today. To me, it really kind of had a positive effect on my life. I sold the company in 2016, and we used that money to buy our dream boat. Now we have kids, and my wife and I are just kind of going with the flow.
We've got some pictures of Chad and his wife, Leanne, and their journeys on that leaky old boat. You can find them on our Instagram. We're at MarketplaceAPM. And listen, while you're there, tell us how the crisis changed you, would you? The hashtag we're using is #HowWeChanged. Coming up,
environmental activities, economic activities, the war on drugs.
And everything else the government writes the rules for. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrials, 14 points to the good today. We'll call that basically flat at 26,064. NASDAQ increased 12 points, 10%, 8,030. S&P 500 up less than a point, 28.97 there. We noted the housing market may have hit a wall in some of the hotter U.S. real estate markets, some being the operative phrase there. So among home builders, D.R. Horton hammered down a 10%. Toll Brothers lost 1%. In home renovations and repairs department, Home Depot pretty much unchanged. We looked at what might be behind a recent rebound for retailers. So retail fashion, Nordstrom zipped up 2.3% today. Macy's and Target both secured about a 10%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the last year for helping keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The crisis in Venezuela is economic in origin, but human in nature, if that makes any sense. The currency, the bolivar, has imploded. Inflation is set to hit 1,000,000% this year. There's a shortage of food and medicine and almost everything else. The United Nations estimates more than 2 million Venezuelans have just left, some of them to Miami, many more, though, to Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, where, as the BBC's Katie Watson reports, there are some challenges to be faced.
The road that heads south from the Colombia-Venezuela border is the start of the migrant trail for many. Every day, hundreds of Venezuelans walk this route, struggling with suitcases whose wheels will wear out long before their journey's over.
We've stopped in a roadside cafe where all along the walls are messages of thanks to the owner of the cafe. And people have written as well on banknotes, which of course are worth nothing now in Venezuela. And one note in particular says, "We're workers, we're fighting for a better life for us and our families. And we thank everybody who can help us." And one of the women who signed the letter says that she has a little boy who's just 25 days old.
Doña Marta is the cafe's owner.
Todos los días, de noche, ya pasa mucho venezolano. En especial, mucha embarazada y mucho niño.
She says many of those who pass by are children and pregnant women. She helps them any way she can.
La mayoría de venezolanos vienen muy flaquitos, bastante.
They arrive very thin, emaciated. Many have been robbed, so they arrive with just one change of clothes.
Further along the road, a Red Cross health center is open for migrants.
¿Usted sufre de latencia?
No.
De pronto es porque viene fatigada y eso, ¿no?
Accountant Mariana isn't feeling very well. She's been walking for 2 days. It's all too much for her mother Miriam, who's holding her hand.
What we want is an opportunity. I used to work as a teacher, and we left because we were desperate. There's no future in Venezuela. Please, help us find work.
Outside, there's a crowd gathering. Dozens of Venezuelans are clambering into a cargo lorry. They're paying $3 each to catch an illegal ride that will take them to the next town. It's a fortune for them, but it avoids a long walk in the cold mountains. Hypothermia is a real threat. While many Venezuelans try their luck finding work, it's becoming harder with more and more people fleeing. They're increasingly moving further south to places such as Ecuador and Peru. At the same time, countries are tightening their borders. Over the weekend, Peru said Venezuelans would need passports to enter, causing a rush of migrants trying to cross before the regulations came into force.
Hola, Daniela. ¿Cómo estás? Soy Luis.
28-year-old Luis Ceballos was one of them. He asks us if he can leave a voice message for his cousin back in Venezuela. He wants to let her know he made it to the border just in time to get his ID stamped.
My plan is to get a job so I can help my family back in Venezuela. Peru has far more opportunities.
It is, for those fleeing, a promised land, but one that, with its border getting harder to cross, will become unattainable for many who are still making the long and arduous journey south.
The BBC's Katie Watson. Brett Kavanaugh is in the hot seat next week before the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearings, obviously on his nomination to the Supreme Court. There will be questions across the broad spectrum of public policy, including, and this is going to sound dense, but it matters a whole lot, including how federal regulations ought to be interpreted, or in layman's terms, who gets to decide what the rules of this economy really mean. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
Regulation is in the eye of the beholder. To some, it's protection for the public, and to others, it's red tape. The current White House beholder is generally against regulation, and he wants like-minded federal judges. White House counsel Donald McGahn leads President Trump's judicial selection process. He spoke earlier this year to the Conservative Political Action Conference.
There is a coherent plan here where actually the judicial selection and the deregulatory effort are really the flip side of the same coin.
Which brings us to nominee Brett Kavanaugh and his views on something known as the Chevron deference, sometimes also called the Chevron doctrine. It's wonky, but if you watch his confirmation hearings with one of those bingo cards, Chevron deference will probably come up. What is it? Well, it's about bureaucrats and how much elbow room they get.
That agencies get some room to maneuver when they're issuing regulations.
Jody Freeman directs the Environmental and Energy Law Program at Harvard. She says, sometimes Congress is vague when it passes a law, say the Endangered Species Act. A few months back, I was reporting from the Columbia River in the Pacific Northwest. That's where the Chinook salmon is endangered. The government protects rare species like this one, but can it also issue rules and industry restrictions to protect their habitat? In other words, the river? Yes, said the Supreme Court, even though the law as written is fuzzy on that point.
And the Supreme Court upheld the agency's decision that it needed to actually protect habitat to provide for the species and make sure it doesn't go extinct. That's a classic example of the Supreme Court deciding that, yes, the agency needs some room to maneuver here in order to accomplish its mission.
This deferring to regulators is known as the Chevron deference, named for a 1984 case involving Chevron when an EPA interpretation of the law prevailed. Freeman says this deference has led to a lot of environmental rules, for instance, giving EPA the discretion to regulate the climate pollutant carbon dioxide. Law professor Ilya Soman at George Mason University sees a broader trend going on here.
The regulatory state has grown large in a lot of dimensions. It regulates more and more activities, environmental activities, economic activities, the war on drugs, federal law enforcement, financial transactions, and many, many others.
Lately, there's been pushback to restrict the bureaucracy, he says. He says Justice Neil Gorsuch, Trump's first pick on the court, feels this way, as does current nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
I think it is fair to say that Kavanaugh is certainly no great friend of Chevron, and that if he or someone like him gets on the court, I think present trends will continue.
Continue in a way that could bring votes restricting regulation into the majority, says Lisa Heinzerling at Georgetown Law.
Four current justices have indicated that they're worried about the extent of deference that the court has been giving to agencies. Another justice would give the court five votes.
What might this mean for environmental rules? Well, as new pollutants are discovered in our air and our water, regulators charged with protecting the public could find their hands tied if Congress is silent on the law, says Ann Carlson. She teaches environmental law at UCLA.
Congress hasn't passed a major environmental statute in 20 years. And that means that the agency is left to try to figure out how do we continue to tackle pollution problems.
She says a lot of greenhouse gas cases are in the pipeline and could land on the high court's docket, which means regulators and how much latitude they have to act could also be on trial. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I'll preface by saying that I was on a reporting trip once down south with David Gurin, now of MSNBC, but formerly of Us. And we had a whole conversation, Gurin and me, about Cheerwine, which I learned that day was a big regional soft drink based in North Carolina. It was news to me, but Gurin, a North Carolinian from way back, had grown up on the stuff. It was a big deal. And I mentioned that by way of getting to this. Coca-Cola announced today it's buying Moxie. That's a 142-year-old regional soda chain based in Maine. It's apparently not to everybody's taste, but it has been around for 142 years. Also, it's Maine's official state beverage. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 14 today. NASDAQ up 12. That's about a 10%. S&P 500 was flat. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.